So welcome everyone to concurrent session 6A. My name is Peter Mulquinney from Taylor Fry. I'll be your chair for this session. So today, Betty Chan, Krista Marjorie Banks and Yusuf Luha will be talking about an exploration of psychological injury in workers' compensation schemes. They're hoping to speak for about half an hour, allowing about 10 minutes for question time after that. But they have asked me to skip over their bios. They want to get straight into their topic. But I don't think they'll need much introduction. But we've got Krista Marjorie Banks from PwC, Betty Chan from PwC, and Yusuf Luha from iCare Self-Insurance. So, Krista, would you like to start?
Thanks, Peter. Well, this morning we've heard a lot about mental health, and there's been quite a bit of discussion at this conference about both mental stress claims and the mental aspects of recovering from physical injury claims. And this is not just our conference that's talking about these issues. A lot of different industries are talking about this. It's a huge issue for our community, estimated $40 billion a year when you take into account lost productivity, medical and direct costs and so on. The establishment of the National Mental Health Commission in 2012 was a milestone in the government investing in thinking about these issues and how to make it better. And one of the things that they identified was the lack of reliable, regular and comprehensive data on which to inform effective policy. So the three of us are sort of largely data people, not mental health specialists. So we set out in this paper to think about how the workers' comp schemes could inform this bigger issue. That didn't work. The number of serious mental stress claims is tiny compared to the 3.6 million Australians who are affected by mental health conditions each year. But because of the workers' comp scheme's focus on early intervention, prevention, coordinated case management and return to work and the rich data that's collected by those schemes, we did feel that they would be in a great position to inform the larger issue about what would be helpful in returning people to work and preventing these kind of claims. We were very lucky in preparing the paper to be able to use the New South Wales public sector as a case study. And we'd like to acknowledge the assistance of the claims managers that we interviewed and the agency staff and the iCare staff and for their permission to use data and those insights. So really the purpose of our paper is to sort of dig into some of the data, what's working, what's not in the New South Wales public sector, to see if that could inform the broader workers' comp thoughts or indeed this larger issue in the community. So what did we do? We did a lot of reading on the subject. I learnt a lot and was then in awe of the people who know so much more about this subject. We spoke to claims managers and agencies, analysed some experience trends, and we tried to see if some trends or steps in the data were in any way correlated with what we were being told and what we heard about what particular initiatives were being tried. And we found some very interesting insights. In particular, one large agency with a significantly improving trend in experience who had invested in a range of programs that seemed to be delivering results. So Yusuf's going to talk about that. We actually even estimated that the return on their investment was probably around 800%. And we found that the data wasn't as useful as we would have hoped. Yusuf will talk about that. And so that's one of our learnings from this exercise of writing the paper was how much better the data could be that could be collected in the workers' comp scheme to support evidence about what works. So in a minute, Yusuf's going to take you through our case study. Betty will talk about our learnings. But I did just want to touch quickly on the New South Wales public sector context and why this does make such a good case study. The workforce has significant exposure to mental stress due to its occupational mix, frontline nature of the jobs that deal with people in emergencies, in life-threatening and stressful situations. This is also true for other public sector workforces in Australia, but this particular one is a large one. and therefore we felt a lot could be learned. It's a very costly issue in the public sector. The claims by number make up about 11%, but 36% of claim costs due to their longer duration off work. This is even more pronounced for emergency services agencies. And then if you consider the cost and impact of secondary mental health conditions on physical injury claims, as well as the broader cost of mental health conditions for the New South Wales public sector workforce that are non-work related, there's a strong case for further investment in initiatives or programs that might actually work to prevent people from going, or keep people in work and return them to work. So I'll ask Yusuf to now take us through his insights from the New South Wales public sector.
Thank you, Krista. Just want to say one thing to start with. I'm not a clinician, and neither am I an actuary. But going through the data that we can see from TMF, we do discover quite a number of things that's quite interesting, and I hope to share some of that with you guys. And perhaps if you have some answers to that, be happy to hear that from you. I'll be going through a number of things on the difference between physical injury versus mental stress, the actual spend on rehabilitation and medical expenses, as well as looking at, well, what is it that we're capturing every time we see a mental stress claims? And further to that, what is it about the complexity of mental stress that's leading to the difference in the cost? So in terms of comparison to physical injuries, mental stress tend to take 5.3 times longer in terms of lost hours and 6.5 times more in terms of actual cost paid. When we looked at the actual medical and rehab spend on this, it's quite interesting that despite paying for almost twice on average for mental stress claims, rehabilitation and medical expense, only 16 cents of every dollar is actually spent on that, versus 41 cents for physical injuries. So why is that? I have difficulty trying to understand that. And you know, one thing that I kind of thought is, it seems like the intensity and the option treatment for physical injury is much higher than for mental stress. Just put it this way, if you get injured physically, you go to an emergency department, you sit there and they'll tell you what's wrong with you, they'll scan you, x-ray you, and they'll fix you. For mental stress, it's the other way around. You tend to have to sit down and tell them what's wrong with you. So in looking at mental stress, obviously we try and understand, well, what caused mental stress? 75% of all mental stress is coded under three different categories: work pressure, work-related harassment and bullying, and other mental stress factors. Now, that's quite interesting because 75% in three buckets. We had a look into data from Safe Work Australia, and it's actually quite interesting because they show similar breakdown of 76%. And what's also quite interesting is that there's 9% there that says exposure to traumatic incident or traumatic event. And whilst reviewing the data, what we found was that there was actually about 10% of claims that's not coded as PTSD, yet the incident narrative actually says PTSD. So let's have a look at this definition of mental stress under the coding of TOOCs. So it includes work pressure, which can be anything from your work backlogs, deadline, responsibilities, which is, you know, volume of work, to interpersonal conflict, you know, with peers or supervisors, to performance counselling, job disciplinary action, promotion, disappointment. It's very broad and very wide-ranging, and yet it's coded under one bucket. Now, the purpose of TOOCs is supposed to be as a major source of injury and disease to be targeted for prevention effort, but clearly What we're seeing there is that it's not granular enough. Another way to look at this is the nature of injuries. 90% of all mental stress claims is coded under three different categories. The bulk of it is anxiety and depression, or both. And it really just tells me, well, if we don't know enough about the cause and the outcome of those injuries, will we have enough information to understand where we can spend the money on the prevention and the treatment? So why is mental stress so difficult to deal with? Well, we've heard a lot yesterday, today about health, well-being, about the journey of a person trying to get treatment. So mental stress is very difficult because whilst it's coded under, you know, three different categories of mechanism and all that, the actual cause is very, very wide, and it can be from bullying, sexual harassment, PTSD, trauma, overworked, and they all need to be handled differently. It can be caused from internal and external. Now, bullying, for example, you can have bullying within the system for school teachers or bullying from the student and the parents. And it can be, you know, due to the nature of occupation, repeated exposure, and so on. Now, what's interesting is in the journey of mental stress, if you think about it, the mind is complex, and regardless of the cause and circumstance, the journey to heal a broken mind is going to be a little bit more difficult. The claims process itself is also not simple. There's a need to balance between providing immediate, genuine care versus fairness of the system. We heard yesterday Greg McCarthy mention about, you know, scheme sustainability, and, well, you know, on one hand, if we want to help people straight away and provide immediate care, we also need to be able to evaluate what's going on. And often, during that process, it becomes an investigation that could be lengthy. It's non-therapeutic and seen as adversarial. Now, yesterday, I think Nikki Elbers gave a talk about the process that led to secondary victimization. Well, our process can lead to that, because if it's an investigation that goes on and on, the injured person may see that as an issue. And finally, the diagnosis and treatment are complex. This morning we heard during a plenary session that, you know, the longer the clinician has been practicing, the more bias they'll have. Well, that's true, because what we found was that despite having a DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual for Mental Stress, that's about 970 pages, all of our mental stress is coded under, most of them under three different buckets. And to add to that imbalance, we know there's clinician bias, and we also know that, you know, often it's very hard for patient to clearly express what's going on with them, which often result in, well, what's wrong with you? Oh, I feel depressed, and, you know, I feel anxiety, and that's where we see most of our claims being coded as, and it's often also the way the claim managers are interpreting what it is, and which shows that there is an opportunity to better understand our claims. Here's another example of a typical journey for somebody that had physical injury versus mental stress. Physical injury, within 24 hours, normally you'll have some sort of treatment. With mental stress, well, you know, it does take a while for the symptoms to come out, a while before the person might say, oh, look, you know, I'm affected some way. And after that, there is the investigation process that may take a little bit longer, and we have heard of, you know, earlier today about the tea and sympathy treatment, where it's really not tackling the issue of PTSD, and it's just going to drag on. So this really highlights the, you know, we have better opportunity for early intervention for physical injury versus mental stress. To add to that, The Workers' Compensation Commission Deputy President Bill Roche, I won't read everything, but just a highlighted bit. He said that it does not matter whether the worker may have been oversensitive or that person may not have reacted to the particular conduct or comment. Employers must take their employees as they find them. Which is really highlight, well, employers need to help their employees build resilience, yeah? But at the same time, our Workers' Comp Amendment Act in 2012 also said that, look, the definition of a disease claim or, you know, mental stress is that the employment has to be the main contributing factor or the main contributing factor to the aggravation. Well, which is it? So having gone through a number of things that we found, you know, try and see from the other way. And what is the good news? Is there any agencies that's been performing well? And what can we draw from the experience and the journey? For example, the New South Wales Education Department, they have implemented a suite of programs on prevention, intervention, triage. And this is early on. This is, you know, before, and we're talking about 10, 12 years ago. And they've actually seen significant reduction in the mental stress claims. And I'll go through some of the numbers with you later. And New South Wales Police, you know, due to the nature of their work, they're much more likely to develop to PTSD. They're exposed daily to all the work that they need to do. And it's often in the paper about the difficulty in whether they have to deal with murder, sexual assault, death, that sort of things. And then lastly, just want to draw on an example from Queensland where they've got a program called Resolve, which does not distinguish between work and non-work related mental health issues, but they'll just provide the support. So let's have a look at the New South Wales Department of Education. The graph to your left there shows the number of claims per 100 FTE over quite a long period of time, starting from about 2003-2004. Until 2011-12, which is about 9 years, the number of physical injuries or rate has actually increased by about 12%. During that same time, their mental stress actually dropped from 1.23 to about 0.93, which is about 24% reduction. So that's really quite interesting because on one hand, the physical injury is going up, yet the mental stress claims coming down. So what is it that they do? Look, I'm not going to go through what they've done since 2004, but suffice, they started with a number of things, and they continue doing it. And if you were to ask them when they started doing this and investing in these programs back then, do you know whether you're going to get $80 million back from all the investment that you do? I'm pretty sure they're going to say, well, we're not sure. But we're going to have to do something because it's a problem. We're going to have to care about our workers. In summary, for education, we estimated that around $10 million from both the Department of Education themselves and the claim managers in managing it, with an estimated return of about $85 million. And that's direct reduction in claims. The benefits or savings would even be higher if we think about, well, for each, you know, school teacher that's not at school, you're going to have to get replaced in FTEs. You're going to have increased sick leave or engagement and so on. So what they've done is really shifted cultures by building resilience. They've got programs. They have claims triage and early intervention. They have hotlines, so whenever an injury occurs, straight away they get called. And then they have a program that says, well, every time there's been a notification, you need to call them back within 48 hours to just say, well, what's going on? And also investment in the claims management and process improvement, which includes systems and various other things. Sorry about that. The examples from New South Wales Police Force. Now, we heard Alan Grenfell yesterday mention about the investment up front in ACC. Well, the New South Wales Police Force is pretty much doing the same. They're doing a lot of programs, and, you know, if you think about it, it's, there's, in the last few years, actually, it has been continuous. There's been over 80 different programs that they've developed and implemented. About 40 of them to promote well-being, which is on prevention side. 18 on how to manage injuries, and a further 11 on rehabilitation redevelopment, redeployment. And these programs include new services, educational awareness, some strategic review, operational improvements, and the result, and this is really, really very positive for them, is that there are now more police officers that's returning to work than they are getting medically discharged a few years ago. And their work and the workforce improvement program has been independently assessed by the Hunter Institute of Mental Health. And basically it's been reviewed as doing commendable or very good work across the majority of elements. But most importantly, one of the key points and the first point that I've actually mentioned is that a significant shift over time to focus on prevention as well as injury management. And we heard Dr. Harvey Swan yesterday said, work is the single most important thing to your well-being. Well, here's an organization that is faced with challenging situation daily, and they've managed to turn all their mentally stressed workers where there are now more of them that's returning to work than they are getting medically discharged. So I say that's a really good outcome. Here's just some of the examples of what they do in terms of their programs. Obviously, this is just a list, a short list. There's 80 of them. I won't go through it. And some are actually quite new in their delivery and within the New South Wales Police Force. And lastly, I just want to touch briefly on a program that's been implemented in Queensland. It's called Resolve at Work. And basically, it's a program that fund mediation and intervention for workplace-related issues. So when a workplace issue occurred, rather than trying to establish liability, they put aside some money and some resources for mediation and intervention to deal with it. And it's whether it's conflict resolution or counselling. And what that's done is, instead of getting people to prove how are you impacted by this situation, and then the person will going to go back, well, I'm going to find every little bit of evidence and say, well, that's because that is the reason why I'm affected. That's why people are getting me stressed out at work or whatever that reason. Conflict resolution and intervention and mediation is trying to quell that before it escalates, becoming into a costly claims. And that program's been costed and with a benefit ranging from about 400% to 800% ROI. I'll now hand you over to Betty, who will summarise the things that we found and the learnings. Betty?
A wise man once said, you can't manage what you can't measure. And we think this is true of the mental stress claims, and we delved into the workers' comp data. We found that the data doesn't break down into sufficiently granular level to identify the causes of stress. So as Yusuf mentioned, 75% of the claims were coded under three codes, and one of them was other. We also don't collect data specifically related to the worker's clinical diagnosis, their treatment type, or the frequency of treatment for that claimant. And by having this information, it built up an evidence base to understand which type of treatment is most effective for what type of claims. Okay. So our second key learning is that early and correct diagnosis is very important. Providing a worker with the right diagnosis is critical to ensuring that they receive the appropriate treatment. And it's especially true for eye care self-insurance with their mix of emergency service workers, where there's a high prevalence of post-traumatic stress disorder due to the occupational nature. Treatment for PTSD compared to other anxiety disorders differ greatly, so a wrong diagnosis would lead to incorrect treatment, which would actually hinder the worker's recovery. We understand that the Diagnostic Statistical Manual 5 is the diagnostic reference manual that outlines a set of criteria, symptoms, descriptions and markers of mental disorders that can be used to help mental health professionals to diagnose mental disorders. But in speaking with the claims managers, we understand this also needs to be delivered by skilled professionals who are able to understand their clinical bias and also to extract the correct information from the patients, because they'll have difficulties in articulating their symptoms precisely. Treatments can include counselling, cognitive behaviour therapy, which is looking at patterns of thinking, recognising those patterns, and then deliberately making changes. There's also such things as exposure therapy, hypnotherapy, and medications such as antidepressants. But the key to recovery is really keeping these workers in continuous high-skill care. Interestingly, we've heard comments about the negative aspects of the employee assistance programs, and this is due to the fact that the patients have to retell their story over again and that there's no feedback loop back into the workers' treatment plan for the claims managers. And our third learning is that prevention is key. Given the significant cost of mental illness to both workers, their families and workplaces, preventing it occurring in the first place is very important. Workplaces need to invest to maintain health and wellness in their employees. One key component of this prevention is, and we've heard it all before, building resilience in workers. This is really important in workers' comp because of that eggshell psyche, that employers take workers as they find them and that their perception of events matter. And hence, when you build resilience in your workforce, then you give them skills and ability to cope with stress and conflict. Another important thing would be for a safe workplace where there's zero tolerance to bullying and harassment. And other things such as coaching, mentoring, having flexible work arrangements, and an engaging and inclusive leadership. For most of us who are office workers, physical activity also helps, as well as encouraging a life outside work. And that's also shown to have positive impact on the mental health of workers. But with these prevention initiatives, they do take time to work through an organisation, and it will be many years before the benefits can be seen. But as Yusuf has already pointed out, they do provide excellent return on investment. And one particular model that Yusuf already pointed out was the Queensland Resolve model. And the unique thing about that is that they consider both work and non-work related issues. They consider the worker as a whole and they help to provide support and health interventions for them. And the Commonwealth also recognises the importance of prevention. So this graph is taken from the report of the National Review of Mental Health Programs and Services. And it shows the tallest blue bar is the amount that's paid on the disability support pension by the Commonwealth Government. And the report highlights that what they actually want to do is move the graph down to the green line, which shows that if they invest upfront in prevention, that they'll be able to see benefits reduce in the disability support pension. And so it's most important that Australia, employers and workers' comp schemes invest to prevent mental stress claims. So in summary, prevention is critical. And this includes building personal resilience in employees to foster a culture where issues are discussed openly and promptly and that support and care is provided to employees. Despite prevention initiatives, psychological injuries will still occur, and in those instances, early intervention will play an important part of speeding up the recovery process. With workers' comp, a significant barrier is establishing liability for those claims, often at the expense of the health of the worker. One thing that does help is having claims managers who are empathetic and who are able to provide consistent and correct advice, and they can build trust and rapport with the worker. An important part of that is early and correct diagnosis by the skilled professionals to access the right treatments. And then in the treatment of psychological injury, continuity of care is very important. Each worker is different and their treatment plans will differ and be tailored to their individual needs and circumstances so that everything can add together to help them to get back on their feet as soon as possible. So that's all we have for today. I might get Krista and Yusuf back up to take questions.
Thanks, Betty, Krista and Yusuf. If anyone has any questions, if you please use the introduce yourself and use the microphone in the centre of the room.
There's two microphones.
Oh, there is. Thank you.
May I start?
Yes, sure, please.
Thank you very much. I found that very interesting. My name is Nikki Ellis. I wanted to ask, I think it's probably Yusuf, but maybe Betty, when you were talking about preventive interventions, you're actually, that's a massive group because some of them are a very sort of lower order of prevention. For example, when you know somebody's already stressed, intervening to prevent it becoming a claim, in a way you could call that secondary prevention, whereas others are quite higher order, thinking about the culture of the organisation, job design. Did you get any sense in the case, and always in prevention, it's an interesting point to know where the best return on investment's going to come. Did you have a sense of where that might be? Because I was interested to note the New South Wales Education intervention used lower order prevention, whereas New South Wales Police seemed to have tried to have a go at really tackling some of the harder prevention interventions.
So when we were talking to them, I think one of the points of our paper is that there was little data on which to base conclusions about where the best return on investment was. So having a model where you could actually understand that and measure it better is, you know, part of, I guess, our conclusion. I certainly got the impression that there was a lot of benefit from some fairly minor interventions around, well, when I say minor, simple things, just about immediate care and the immediate sort of connection with the person who was having the issue seemed to have a huge impact in sort of changing their pathway from one of adverse, you know, sort of adverse discussion and being away from work and then trying to reconnect with them, keeping them in the sort of in the loop and feeling cared for, just that simple thing made such a big difference. So the hotline and having some skilled people who were prepared to just spend time on the phone talking to people and not necessarily looking at the workers' comp legislation but just understanding the person, their issue and talking to them about what might happen to them if they did put in a claim or if they didn't put in a claim and how that pathway was going to happen for them seemed to be a very simple way that they sort of directed people, you know, back down the path of staying at work and just getting assistance to stay.
Because you're not really tackling the cause then, are you? I mean, if the cause was work-related, because obviously it may not be, but...
That's right.
Mm.
So
okay,
it was sort of like a screen. There were a lot of examples we were given about, you know, grievances or you know, things that the worker perceived as major, but the person on the phone was able to sort of put them in perspective and assist the worker with realising that if they wanted to go down this path of putting in a claim for something that was a little trivial by most people's standards, then that would be a serious, you know, this is likely to be what would happen, and almost convincing them to sort of have another go at getting back to the workplace, mm-hmm. trying to resolve the issues, getting some counselling and assistance appropriately to help them work through those issues.
Thank you.
Yeah. Robert Auerbach. Understanding that this is probably a bit beyond the scope of your initial paper, I just wondered whether you would have any comment about the difficulties in detecting, quantifying, and costing secondary psychological overlay to initial injury.
So I think secondary psych claims are very hard to detect. So we know with physical injuries, often if there's a delay in I guess, you know, them returning to work, there's often a psychological component. I understand with the claims data, sometimes there's a separate claims flag that is raised so that you can see that this person has both a physical and a psych claim, but oftentimes there's nothing raised, so you don't actually know, and it's really there's no data that's captured in the New South Wales system. But we know the it is a massive issue because it does hinder the return to work process, whereas, you know, you have someone with exactly the same injury and they could go, first person could go back to work within a week, but the other person could linger on and on. But, yeah, I think, again, starting with data, because we don't have that data that clearly articulates who has secondary site claims, then that you run into issues of, well, how do you quantify it if you don't know?
And I guess I would just, you know, sort of plead to people like you who really understand data to start helping us develop metrics. I reckon that this is probably a great component of the 20% of claims that are soaking up 80% of our resources, and we don't have any way of measuring at this point.
Yeah, and actuaries are good with data, so I guess that's why we're providing comment to say we need more data.
Following up on that question about data, you're saying using iCare self-insurance data. So they don't have any information about billing and treatment, so you're saying they could have a physical injury, and then if you're looking at secondary complication, psych injury, perhaps if they were seeking psychological treatment, you could see that in the data, in the billing data, for example.
We actually tried that because Betty had the same idea, and she's very clever. So she made that suggestion. Look, why don't we have a look at those people that were coded as having physical injury and look at from the payments information to see how many of them have counselling services or psychological services. But what we found is there's hardly any and not many at all, and that the data is just not robust enough. However, that doesn't stop us from thinking, well, does that mean there is no secondary psychological injuries? No, we do believe there is. And, you know, but what we're trying to do is sometimes understand why is it that not being raised? Is that the person, well, whilst they're recovering at home, they're getting worried about, oh, what's work going to be like after being away from work for 6 weeks? How is my colleague going to treat, you know, how is everyone going to think about it? And what's my workload is going to be like? And so obviously there is some component there that will hamper, and especially if the injury is severe enough, you know, the person might actually be depressed about not being able to do what they used to be able to do with their family and their kids. And so it is a big, massive issue, and, you know, ideally there is a flag. And just like the way, you know, we looked at the mechanism of injury, well, there's just not enough information. We need to get more information. And anecdotally, some of the agencies that we talk to actually collect more information than required by the legislation so that they can understand and triage their claims better.
Yeah, that was my second question about what kind of other information should IKEA self-insurance data be collecting, and, yeah, what kind of information do you think you need from them, and would they be collecting this information given your feedback?
I guess a start with a better granularity of the TOOCS coding would help. Having 75% of a mechanism of injury or the course of injury falling under three buckets, you know, one of them's other. One of them's so broad and it's really not telling me much. And then, yes, there is a bullying and harassment. Even that is not very clear, because you can have bullying and harassment from various areas, from within your system, from external. And, you know, being a scheme that looks after government public servant, our, you know, people deal with public out there. And sometimes during the delivery of service, the public may not be very happy and they, you know, want to vent. And our workforce face the brunt of that venting.
I think we might have one more.
David Hart, dinosaur actuary from the 1970s. A couple of weeks ago, I was asked to take part in a public relations day put on by the local area police command. Yes, we had the fun things like sitting in one of the police vehicles and having a look at all their technology. But there were two things that were particularly emphasised there, and this came right from the superintendent in charge of the command, and that was that their prime concern is that their staff, their officers, can go home safely at night. It is an emphasis that we, in the normal work day, take for granted. Secondly, the programs they put in place include right down the chain within the command, there must be an interview with each of the officers every month to pick up any basic issues such as not sleeping at night, that sort of thing. Every 3 months there is an interview with a psychologist, and that just really impressed me as to the way the emphasis, and this was coming right from the top down the system. Now to a question. Are you finding in the data that you're analysing that psychological injuries are more apparent in larger firms or larger organisations than smaller? And if this is the case, is there therefore a role, a much greater role for self-insurance type operations where the case management or claims managers are closer to the individual and understand the individual and organisation better?
I'm sorry, it'll have to be quick because we've got people about to come in.
Most of the data we looked at was just for the New South Wales public sector, which is obviously a large organisation. We did look at large and small agencies within that, but I'm not sure that we probably did that in a way that's really easy to answer your question, absolutely.
I'll just add to that. I think the differences is not really as noticeable with the size. It's more what industry they're in, whether they're healthcare workers or whether they're emergency service workers. They're the one where, you know, you're seeing a much higher prevalence.
Okay, thanks, Krista, Yusuf and Betty. If you could all join me in thanking the presentation today.